Well, last week, Les had to fill in, of course. I was scheduled to speak and I was in no shape to do so. But he continued with a subject that he had been working on and presenting for a few messages. But in listening to it, I realized that there is an overall idea that exists in the Christian world that it goes without saying, it seems. People accept a certain idea and it overlays and reflects back into the belief system of our time. Now, Les's message focused pretty much on the idea of there being a third person in the Godhead. Now, that's a very popular idea in what is called Christianity today. The problem is that such an idea was never a part of early Christian theology. The New Testament was written pretty and confirmed and canonized pretty much before the end of the first century. The Apostle John wrote his epistle in the early 90s AD. 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John were written about that time frame. The book of Revelation was known to have been written about the middle 90s AD. And with that, the New Testament was pretty much concluded. So if there had been any idea in there of a third person, it should be reflected in the wording or the subject matter of any or all of the New Testament books. And what should be obvious is it isn't there. Such an idea didn't come into being for another two centuries at least. We don't hear much about this thought of God's Spirit being a third person until the early 4th century. So for 200 years after the New Testament, was written, such an idea never came under discussion. It's something that developed later under the theological forces that were entering into the New Testament church, but much, much later. The issue of the first century was not any third person. The issue in the first century was the existence of a second person. That was the problem area. That was the issue that created all of the opposition between two groups. Initially, the early New Testament church was Jewish. Their belief system was pretty much Jewish of the day. Now, by that I mean to say, Judaism of the first century is not the Judaism of the present day. There have been drastic changes that has existed, you know, after, let's say, the 4th century. The Council of Nicaea in 325 exposed a lot of what was happening in the church at the time. Other ideas were being brought in that the early church would never have even thought to ask. It was so far outside of their peripheral thinking What was the problem? What was the issue that eventually separated the early New Testament church from its Jewish roots? Was the idea of a second person. That there were two beings in the Godhead. The thought of there being a second person was contrary to Jewish theology. For that matter, it is to this day. But there is evidence that they understood to a point. Now, they came to a point of rejection, but they understood to a point. In the second century BC, and we don't have a specific date as to when this all happened, but one thing we can credit the Jews with is when they did something to alter their texts, they took very careful note of it. Now, in the Bullinger Bible, he has repeated what the Jews noted regarding their reaction to certain of their own scriptures. It's known as the 134 emendations of the Sopharim. This is not some new and weird thing. This has been known for centuries. In 134 places, Jewish theologians chose to alter the text because they didn't like what it said. Okay? And they admitted it. Now, there's two important passages where this took place. One of them is Psalm 110, verse 1. A very familiar passage written by David. Psalm 110. David writes this. He says, "The Lord," what? "The Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." Does that give you a picture? How would a Jew react to that? One sitting at the right hand of the other. Are they both divine? Could this be if they weren't? The Jewish persuasion of the day had to look at that and somehow arrange their thinking where there is the greater being, which David calls the Lord. You'll notice that's all caps. That is the Tetragrammaton, YHVH, referring to Yahweh. Okay? But Yahweh says unto David's Lord, what? David had a different Lord? The Lord is saying unto David's Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Well, they were somewhat okay with that because the Lord was Yahweh. But David's Lord was Adonai. So that sort of answered their issue to a point. However, when you get down a few verses, verse 4, where it says, "The Lord has sworn and will not repent. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. The Lord at your right hand shall strike through the kings in the day of his wrath. He shall judge among the heathen. He shall fill the places with the dead bodies, he shall wound the heads over many countries. Problem is, and they knew this. Okay, this will become important later. But they changed the Lord in verse 5, which used to read Yahweh. They changed it to Adonai. And they admitted it. It's documented. They wrote in the margins of their original text what they had changed. Because it was a problem for them that there were two beings, co-equal beings, one sitting at the right hand of the other. How do you process that if you're going to hold to the religious belief system of the day, which was strict monotheism, that there's only one God being? That was the idea. That was the underlying idea of the Jewish religion of the day. Okay? Now, another place where they had this problem was in Daniel chapter 7. And this was written centuries later. But Daniel chapter 7. And you have to read this whole chapter carefully to sort out in your mind who is who. Daniel 7. And we're going to look around, somewhere around verse 13. Daniel says, I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Now here's what's happening. Okay, one like the Son of Man is being brought before one like, or the one who is, the Ancient of Days. Are you clear in your mind as to which is which here? They brought him near before him, and there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Do we have a clear picture of who that's talking about? Okay, let's move on down to about verse 22. Where it says, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Who is the Ancient of Days in this picture? Who is going to give judgments to the saints? When are the saints going to take possession of the kingdom? You get the picture here? In one place, the Son of Man is brought before the Ancient of Days. But down here in verse 22, that other being, that second being, is referred to himself as the Ancient of Days. Are there two beings who are both the Ancient of Days? You see, this is the issue in the early New Testament church. This was the issue that existed between the Jewish religion of the time and the emerging Christian theology. It wasn't the idea of a third person. The big problem area was the idea that there were two beings. Now, we've seen in Psalm 110, and we've seen here in Daniel 7, where either one is referred to as Yahweh. Either one is referred to as the Ancient of Days. In John 5:37, Jesus is recorded as, we could say, throwing a glass of ice water in the face of the theologians of the day. John 5:37, a very well-known scripture with us, not necessarily with everyone. 5:37. He says, and the Father himself. Now keep in mind, the belief system of the day thought that Yahweh was the Father. Jesus is saying, and the Father himself, which has sent me, has borne witness of me. And here's the hand grenade. You neither heard his voice at any time, nor seen his shape. What would they think of that? Because the Yahweh that they worshipped had been seen and heard so many occasions. You've got Adam and Eve in the garden. Who was that? You had Abraham when God made a covenant with him in Genesis 15. Not only was one being involved where he brought bread and wine, but later that same evening, there were two representations. Who was that? Do they never see the Father? You got to realize, this is going to go through their minds. This is going to cause a reaction. We don't see a written reaction, but what he said to them was profound because it exposes the fact that they never really understood that there was another being higher than the one that they worshipped as Yahweh, the one who created, the one who rested on the Sabbath. When he said to them, I am the Lord of the Sabbath, think of the implications of that. He's telling them that he was that Lord that they had been worshiping ignorantly. Okay? Not allowing the idea that one of the beings could come into the flesh and interact with humanity. The Father could not do that. There's an important reason why. But you had Jacob who wrestled with God all night. We have elders at Mount Sinai. The 70 elders went up and ate with and saw God. They never heard his voice or seen his shape. How would they react to such a thing? What he was showing them was something profound, that there was a defect in their theology that they just didn't know how to process. And I can't say that since have they learned how to process it. Moses saw God and heard his own name uttered. Now, it's interesting, when he did that, he said Yahweh twice. Okay? You can go look at those references. I don't have them here. I threw this together rather quickly last night. But that occasion when Moses asked Christ or the second being of the Godhead. Show me your glory. And he agreed. He says, I will. So he put Moses in the cleft of a rock. And he held his hand where Moses couldn't see his front side. But as he passed by, he said, Yahweh, Yahweh, is Elohim. Now think about that. What he's telling him is that there are two Yahwehs in the Elohim. That is so fundamental, and yet the Jewish religion, since the return from captivity to the present day, can't process such an incredible idea that there are two beings in the Godhead. Deuteronomy 6:4 is one of the major scriptures that sort of locked in what we would consider Jewish theology ever since. 6:4. And this is a mantra with the Jewish people. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. From that, they've taken the position that God is but a single being. The idea that there was a second Yahweh in this picture just didn't compute. And we can see the strength of that a little later in Christ's ministry. But Deuteronomy 6:4 should have created some degree of rethinking. Now, the Jewish position is largely based on the idea of a single person Godhead. One being. There's just one God. Okay? Problem is, there were some major areas of study in the Jewish world referred to as the two Jehovahs of the Pentateuch. There are volumes written about this. Two Jehovahs of the Pentateuch, those being the first five books of the Old Testament. Now there's another area of study called the two Jehovahs of the Psalms. The Jewish world recognized the fact, at least the upper level understood the fact, that there were two beings in the Godhead. A more contemporary writer has produced a major, I don't know if it's a book or an article, it's titled, The Two Powers in the Heavens. And that was Brian Fulton. The other two, the two Jehovahs of the Pentateuch and the two Jehovahs of the Psalms, were written by Carl Franklin. And I have those if anyone wants to see them and read them. They're rather involved. But they explain the fact that the Jewish religion of the first century, at least, should have had some kind of idea of the fact of there being two Jehovahs in the Elohim. But they didn't accept that. And they wouldn't accept it. And in so many places in the Old Testament where they see one being talking to the other being, somehow they had to reword it to obscure the fact. And that is what is known as the 134 emendations of the Sopharim. You want to look that up. I think I have that paper as well. I'm not sure. It's been a long time. But here's the thing. This is not something, this is not an idea that the Jewish world hasn't looked into, hasn't discussed it. They ultimately rejected the idea, but they were aware. Okay? They were aware. And you'll see why this is important. In Isaiah 9:6, another little bomb tossed into the theological persuasion of the time. Isaiah 9:6, it says, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given." Son of whom? "And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace." It's in their own scriptures. Who is a son being called the Mighty God? Verse 7, "Of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end upon the throne of David." Whoa. What? This child who is born is a descendant of David? What? "And upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." How would they have understood this particular passage? They might have dismissed the idea as being simply a Messiah type, not a divine person, not a God-level being. Somehow they had to arrange their thinking to dismiss what is so obvious, that this son who is to be born is going to be the Mighty God. Now the Apostle Paul understood. He knew. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 10. Okay. Now, Paul was a trained theologian. He was trained by the best of the best of his time. 1 Corinthians 10. He would have understood the Jewish thinking of the time. First Corinthians 10, verse 4. I'm going to start in verse 1. "Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea and did all eat the same spiritual meat and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." Paul understood the fact that the God being that Israel dealt with throughout history, and particularly during the Exodus period, was the second person, was Christ. Now in the Gospel of John, and in the first epistle of John, John introduces the simple fact that there were two beings, that one was with the other, and one was God and the other was God. John understood. You can read that yourself. But it's in the introductory chapter of both of those passages. John presented the idea of a two-person Godhead. I'm not saying it flew well in his day. But it was beginning to shape the theology of the early New Testament church. They understood a two-person Godhead. Now, of those people who are inclined to think along the lines of a third person, people that we would call Trinitarians, and it's a popular idea in the religious world today. Such an idea was not introduced in the first century. It was not remotely a thought during the time when the New Testament was being written. It was a couple of centuries later. But if you're ever talking to a person who is, let's say, of a Trinitarian persuasion, you could ask those people, do you identify with the Athanasian view, or do you identify with the Arian view? And that'll probably stop the conversation right there. They're going to say, what are you talking about? People don't know. They don't know the beliefs of their own denomination. There were two basic ideas in the early 4th century. One was that there is a single God being who can manifest himself under any of three hypostases. And they took a word used by the Apostle Paul. It meant something else. But being Greek and being sophisticated sounding, you could get away with it. Everybody here understand what a hypostasis is? Dr. Stavronisi introduced that to us. But, of course, he misused the term, as do many of them. But one idea is that there is a single being, a one-person Godhead, who can represent himself to people under any of three of these spirit manifestations. The other idea is the Arian view. And the Arian view is different in that it accepts a multi-person Godhead. Now, our position is more in line with the Arian view, though not to the same degree that it ultimately was developed. So you've got two possible persuasions here. One is a single-person Godhead, which accommodates the strict Jewish monotheistic position, and the other, which reflects the early New Testament understanding that there is more than one Yahweh in the Elohim. Do we get the picture there? That was the issue between the Jewish religion of the day and the early New Testament church. They had begun to diverge. They had begun to understand the fact that the God being that mankind had been dealing with from the time of Adam was what we could today call the second person. They didn't know of the first person. They had no occasion to know of the third person. I'm sorry, of the first person. What would make them think so? Let me read this quote. In general, the intent of the Trinitarian doctrine, as it was developing in advance of the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD and more fully adopted at the next council a generation later, some 60 years later, was intended to resolve essential questions regarding the personhood of God while accommodating the monotheistic discipline inherited from its Jewish roots. You see what they're trying to do? They want to introduce the truth, but the truth has a negative reaction with their Jewish roots. So what do? You have to put together some kind of formula. The early church recognized the two-person Godhead, a doctrine often referred to as the Father and the Son. If you want to do an interesting Bible study, go through and find all the places that refer to the Father and the Son. It's all through it. That idea is reflected by John and by Paul in so many of their epistles. Yet the indelible monotheistic prerequisite long-standing in Judaic religion had also to remain inviolate with later theologians and provided a basis to justify, eventually, laying aside the early church's original understanding. Now, even Dr. Hay admitted that the view in the first century bore little to no resemblance to that of the fourth. He recognized, and we should know this, that there was a drift in thinking. And that drift has brought us into this confusion area. And I appreciated Les's comment here. This is a quote, I don't know. Handbook of Christian Truth. This is what it says. The mind of man cannot fully understand the mystery of the Trinity. He who would try to understand the mystery fully will lose his mind. How's that for theology? But he who would deny the Trinity will lose his soul. Huh? This sounds like an ultimatum. Believe what we say or else. Now, I remember as a young person in a Trinitarian Protestant church. I might have been 5 or 6 years old. I don't know. But I remember distinctly. In this regard, the minister said, to those who don't believe, no explanation is possible. To those who do believe, no explanation is necessary. Okay? That's the foundation upon which this whole issue is built. Blind acceptance. No proof. No realities here. Just blind acceptance. Can't explain it to you, folks, but you have to believe it. It's not like it's in the Bible or anything. Now, another factor that's come to be, and I've heard this recently, there are Protestant theologians who like to go back and read into the Bible the idea that they're thinking about, even though there's nothing really substantial there. They like to read it back into it. I've heard of one group who went to the Old Testament and basically tried to present a case for a third person in the Godhead from the Old Testament. Others have done the same with the New Testament, even though it isn't really there. The early New Testament church understood something that the Jews could not or would not. Very interesting passage is in Psalm 16. I'm going to read it off the paper here, but it says, "Preserve me, O God, for in you do I put my trust." Question here was, who's the speaker? "O my soul, you have said unto the Lord, you are my Lord. My goodness extends not to you, but to the saints that are in the earth, and to the excellent, in whom is all my delight. Their sorrow shall be multiplied that hasten after another God. Their drink offerings of blood will I not offer, nor take up their names unto my lips. The Lord is the portion of mine inheritance and of my cup. Thou maintainest my lot. The lines are fallen unto me in pleasant places. Yes, I have a goodly heritage. I will bless the Lord who has given me counsel. My reins also instruct me in the night seasons. I have set the Lord always before me because he is at my right hand." Boing. What's that saying? This writer, whoever it is saying the Lord, Yahweh, is at my right hand. Wasn't it the other way around? Didn't Psalm 110 tell us that Adonai is at Yahweh's right hand? This is backwards. He is at my right hand. I shall not be moved. Therefore, my heart is glad and my glory rejoices. My flesh also shall rest in hope. For you will not leave my soul in hell. Neither will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. Do we realize the implication of what this is saying? Both Peter and Paul spoke of and endorsed this role reversal. We think of the second person being at the right hand of the first person. This is flipped. This is flipped. Peter spoke of this in Acts chapter 2. And he preserved the reversal. Now, it was explained away by saying, oh, this is David writing. This is David, Acts chapter 2. Well, Peter didn't think so. Acts chapter 2. Verse 22, "You men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs, which God did by him in the midst of you, as you yourselves also know, him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, you have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain, whom God has raised up, having loosed the pains of death, because it was not possible that he should be holden of it." Verse 25, "For David speaks concerning him." David's not speaking concerning himself. David is speaking concerning him, where he says, "I foresaw the Lord always before my face, for he is on my right hand, that I should not be moved." Peter is recognizing the fact of this particular, what we would call, positional reversal. You see, the second being is dealing with humanity. And the second being is being supported in that ministry by the first being. Yahweh is at Adonai's right hand in this picture. Peter understood that. David, in writing the 16th Psalm, spoke of or for Christ. It's Christ who is quoted as saying, "He is on my right hand." Reading Peter's statement that it isn't noticeable unless we compare it with the Psalm, the "my" in this situation is not David himself. Peter preserves this position reversal referred to earlier, where God the Father is pictured as being at the Son's right hand in this particular situation. Now, on the same subject, Paul says the same thing, Acts 13. Acts 13. This was new to Christian theology. They were beginning to understand something that their Jewish counterparts just couldn't. And that veil, let's say, remains to this day. Paul in Acts 13, verse 30. It says, "But God raised him from the dead." Not talking about David. "And he was seen many days of them which came up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who are his witnesses unto the people. And we declare unto you glad tidings, how that the promise which was made unto the fathers, God has fulfilled in the same unto us, their children, in that he has raised up Jesus again, as it is also written in the second Psalm, 'You are my son, this day have I begotten thee.'" In verse 34, "And as concerning that he raised him up from the dead, now no more to return to corruption, he says on this wise, 'I will give you the sure mercies of David.' Wherefore he says also in another Psalm, 'You shall not suffer your Holy One to see corruption.' For David, after he had served his own generation by the will of God, fell asleep and was laid unto his fathers and saw corruption. But he whom God raised again saw no corruption." Now this is another proof. This is another witness, the Apostle Paul, saying that this wasn't David speaking for or of himself, demonstrated by the fact that David's body did see corruption. So the issue between the early New Testament church and the established Jewish religion of the day was not the idea of a third person. That was way outside. The issue was the idea of a two-person Godhead. Jesus knew that. Jesus knew what their problem was. And he stuck it up their noses at the most critical point in time. Matthew 26, 64. Here again, scriptures that we know well. Matthew 26, 64. Verse 63, "But Jesus held his peace." There was a very important question on the table. "Jesus held his peace, and the high priest answered and said unto him, 'I adjure you,'" you're under oath, pal, "'I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are Christ, the Son of God.' Jesus said unto him, 'You have spoken correctly. Nevertheless, I say unto you, Hereafter shall you see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest went nuts. Verse 65. Yeah, I mean, did you ever try to tear your clothes? This isn't a matter of ripping a row of buttons. I mean, these had garments that, man, you just don't tear some things. But he went loony. Why? Because Christ stuck it up their nose. The fact that they understood something that they wouldn't admit. They knew there were two beings in the Godhead. These two verses, Psalm 110 and Daniel 7, were verses that were long discussed in their theological circles. And they chose to reject it. They didn't care about the truth. They only cared about their religious persuasion. That was the most important thing to them. Here was the issue. Could there be a second person in the Godhead? The Jewish reaction to that was pretty berserk. Unthinkable. I mean, it was true, but it was just unacceptable. Such an idea. That was what Christ's ministry was all about. To introduce himself as the being that they had been dealing with since the time of Adam. Since the Exodus. But that issue would have to be resolved long before they could ever entertain the idea of a third person. So if you're going to look back into the New Testament or the Old and try and find evidence for such a thing, keep in mind it was unthinkable until at least the 4th century. What we need is to understand and develop in our minds the basic teaching of the New Testament of a two-person Godhead, the Father and the Son. Now, yes, they come to us, they relate to us in and through God's Spirit, yes. But that's a separate issue, but that certainly does not create a third person. So let's understand. The issue of the day was a two-person Godhead, not a strict monotheistic single being.